Well, hello everyone. Michael J. Nelson here. Hello, 372 pages people. Connor is away. I believe he is at a quilting seminar that seamlessly moves into a corgi meetup. So, you know, this is something he picks up and, you know, goes to a quilting thing at least once every couple of months. And the corgi meetup just happened to be, you know, that was advantageous. It was next door. So perfect for him and perfect for me to steal away with a little time here and do a classical mini. Because, you know, Connor's, he wouldn't allow it if he were around. So when the cat's away. And today we are going to be talking about one of the greats, one of the great characters, great performers, great composers in all of classical music. And before I get to it, I'll just say, you know, great characters, there's a lot of them in classical music. Beethoven, right? He's a great character. Besides being Beethoven, you know, you will never get to the end of anecdotes, stories, myths, legends about Beethoven and what a great character. Liszt, Franz Liszt, great character. Brahms, maybe not so great, but still a pretty good character. Bach, the greatest composer to have ever lived, he's not such a great character. I mean, I love him. I love his Bartleby the Scrivener thing, where just quietly going about doing insane and brilliant things year after year after year, reinventing, or like pretty much inventing Western music. People don't sit down and go, I got to tell you this amazing Bach story. There's just not a lot of them. Mozart, right? Great character. A lot of great stories. Papa Haydn, even maybe a little better than Bach. Same deal going on, just super prolific, reinventing music, doing it sort of quietly. I suspect he was a little more rakish than we know, but we don't know a ton about Haydn. But okay, which brings us to this composer. This is Rachmaninoff, Sergei Rachmaninoff. Great character. Why am I talking about him? Well, I have a little bit of a personal connection to him. When I was a young piano student and just going bananas for Vladimir Horowitz, I mean, my confused parents would, at my request, buy me records. Yeah, record albums of Horowitz. And I would just sit in the dark and listen to them endlessly on headphones. And my poor dad, he's come up on this podcast. He was the most working class of working class guys. He would just see me spinning up another Horowitz album and just shake, you know, set his lunch pail down and shake his head at me. Anyway, what does that have to do with Rachmaninoff? Horowitz was, of course, acquainted with Rachmaninoff. They met. I was surprised when I looked up research that they had not met in Russia. I don't think, anyway. I think they met in America because Horowitz came later. Horowitz came in the 20s, and Rachmaninoff had been there since he fled Russia after the revolution, like pretty much during the revolution. He was like, hey, you got to go on this tour. And friends said, you can't go back to Russia. Russia's on fire. This is 1917, obviously. So he said, yeah, I'll go on this tour. And he just, you know, hopped a steamership for America, and boom, there he was. Now, he already had fame when he landed in America. People already were like, I think even when he got off the steamer ship in America, there's like a crowd of people going, hey, Rachmaninoff, can I get a selfie with you? So pretty amazing and pretty, you know, that's not typical, obviously, of a classical. But he had, you know, was a touring pianist, so had some fame there, just like an absolute, his authority at the keyboard, his fieriness. He's a big, tall dude, gawky, kind of had a, you know, military haircut, always looked morose. That's one of the things that makes him a great character. Obsessed with his own death. So here's... I'll just get into the my understanding of Rachmaninoff's stories. Most of these confirmed by my scant research on the subject. Others, I'm pretty sure I just kind of read them on the back of albums. Yes, on the liner notes of albums. But anyway, so Horowitz comes in the 20s to the United States, and as a concert pianist, there was a lot of rumors about there's this guy who's just, he's on fire. You have to hear him. And he's going to play a Rachmaninoff piano concerto. I don't know if this is at Carnegie Hall, which I think was once a Steinway Hall. I think that was the place that Steinway was set up, and they just turned it into... Somebody correct me if I'm wrong. But anyway, it was, you know, in New York City. He does a big concert. He plays a Rachmaninoff piece. And there in the audience is Rachmaninoff, who... I guess they talked afterwards. I don't know that much is known about it, but I it makes me laugh, the comical thing of, you know, Horowitz firing off this Rachmaninoff piece, and Rachmaninoff, like, in the front row, you know, his arms crossed, just pointing a huge beam of disapproval at Horowitz, who's desperately trying to make a splash and make a living in America. Hilarious to imagine. I hope it's true. I believe it is. So here's some other stories that, as a young piano student, I'd always heard. Okay, number one, Rachmaninoff was a protege of Tchaikovsky's. You know, was hugely influenced by Tchaikovsky. And evidently, after his first symphony, after Rachmaninoff wrote and performed his first symphony, he pulled a Tchaikovsky because the first symphony just got trashed. It got a really bad reception. And I'm not going to make light of this in any way, but Tchaikovsky had these mental health issues and depression. And anytime there was criticism from his colleagues, it would drive him to despair. And evidently Rachmaninoff inherited this, which it seems, you know, a little bit out of character for him, but this is apparently how it goes, is that he, from letters and everything, he was so upset by people just bashing his first symphony that he just kind of withdrew from life and, you know, wouldn't compose again for quite some time, didn't do anything. Now, you could say here, like, well, he has that, he was, you know, from the quote-unquote aristocracy of Russia, so he's able to just go, I shall go to a sanatorium for 4 years and do nothing. Most of us don't have that luxury, but, you know, I'll just leave that there. So that's what he did. Now, was the First Symphony terrible and deservedly bashed by critics? I don't think so. It's not. It's different from his other things. He sort of took a turn. This one actually doesn't really sound like him, but that's not a bad thing. I think it's good. So let's listen to a little of Rachmaninoff's First Symphony right here. I mean, would you bash that? That's not so bad. All right, here's another story, Rachmaninoff's story. This one I could not find any corroboration anywhere on the internet. And I looked for like 35 seconds. So there's no way. I don't know what this is, but I'm going to leave you with it because it's too good to not say. But again, I'm sure I read it on the back of a 12-inch record jacket. All right, kids? It's this, that he was on one of his performance tours and he was not allowed, or for some reason either didn't show up or they just didn't allow it. He did not have a piano to practice on while going on a piano performance tour. And so he's on this steamer ship, and he took with him a roll of cloth with the piano keys on it that he would then unroll onto a table, practice his fingering and chord structures and whatnot, obviously hearing it all in his giant Russian head. And that even that, even just him smashing his fingers on a felt-covered tabletop, caused the people in the cabin next to him to be upset by the noise this weirdo was making. Hard to believe, but I heard it. I'll leave it there. Another great Rachmaninoff story. Unlike a lot of classical giants at the time, he was very, very popular. You know, like I said, fans would show up. Like, he was a movie star. So he had money. And he worked. He took tours. He had a lot of interests. Like, he was constantly being offered, you know, will you become the head conductor of our orchestra? But I guess he found it more lucrative to just tour as a pianist. And so, you know, he had money. And he used that money to buy a brownstone building in New York that he entirely staffed with Russian-speaking servants and would constantly just only have Russian expats over, like hanging around the house, sitting around, you know, sipping tea and just being gloomy. And, you know, at that time, you know, Horowitz also making a name for himself. Anytime Horowitz concert would do the same thing, it would cause people to just go, like, musicians loved Horowitz. And so anyway, Horowitz married Wanda Toscanini. So Horowitz and Wanda were, you know, a sight around New York and walking around. And Horowitz would stop by Rachmaninoff's brownstone and, you know, walk in, and there would be like Russian dirges playing and people sitting around gloomily. And then in the middle of it, Rachmaninoff, and apparently from, I read a biography of Horowitz, he would be like, hey man, you okay, Sergei? What's going on? You know, this is America, you don't have to, and he would be, please speak Russian, you know, so. Hilarious that he created his own world just so he could continue to be a gloomy Russian. And because this is becoming almost not mini anymore, I'd better cut it off. And I probably have to talk about his critical reception, which has always been pretty complicated. I think if you're not into classical music, whatever, you just assume that Rachmaninoff, towering giant, right? You hear his name all the time. I think people love him. He was pretty critically bashed when he was composing and performing. Both back in Russia and when he got to the U.S., I think a lot of that obviously comes from the fact that he was enormously successful. He was, his, you know, piano virtuosity is, of course, legendary. He famously had enormous reach. His hands were gigantic. And so as a kid, when I would go to play his you know, preludes and things, they're basically rewritten for people who don't have a, you know, 3 foot reach from thumb to a pinky. I can hit an octave, you know, easily. He could hit an octave and a fifth, evidently. The octave and a third is sort of the, you know, I had a friend playing piano who could hit the octave and a third. This is pretty impressive. The octave and a fifth is insane. Again, probably read from the back of a jacket, so someone looked that up. But when you see his original fingering and then the stuff that you're supposed to do, it's always scaled down for a mini hand. So anyway, he had that going on, is that he was just, his piano playing was apparently, you know, electrifying. So because he's electrifying audiences, he's probably going to take some flack from critics. And he did. But here's a piece. I read this. I'll give credit to the late, great Terry Teachout, wrote a piece about him. And apparently modern composer Walter Piston, modern being, you know, 20th century modern composer, had contempt for Rachmaninoff. And I'm familiar with Walter Piston. I'm familiar with his works. I'm familiar with his pedagogy. Let me ask you this. When's the last time you listened to a Walter Piston symphony? That's what I thought. And I will confess, I'll lay it on the table. I kind of hate that smug 20th century Rochester School of Music bunch, your Howard Hansons, your David Diamonds, your Walter Pistons. I mean, I just don't care enough about them to hate them, but their music and there's something about it that I can't warm to them. And so when I hear that a Walter Piston says about Rachmaninoff that he has contempt for him, and that makes me like Rachmaninoff more and dislike Piston more. I'm sorry. I'll leave it there. Plus, I will confess, I did have to study out of Walter Piston's textbook when I was in school. So for that, he can go to hell. But yeah, anyway, Rachmaninoff was the, you know, quote-unquote last of the romantics out of Russia, so he was bound to take a lot of heat. But I don't think his material is clunky or cloying. And he certainly had modernist touches, so it wasn't like he was this hidebound, you know, romantic. There are romantic themes, obviously. If you want romantic themes, just endless romantic themes and beauty, I recommend his... He called it All Night Vigil. It's also called Vespers. You know, I don't think he was a religious man, but he wrote this, you know, religious service, the All Night Vigil, for, you know, that gloomy Russian choir. And this is just I heard it described as a steady outpouring of Byzantine gloom. So if you're into that, but it's beautiful. And it's one of the few things that I can play from Rachmaninoff that my lovely wife will go, "Oh, that's lovely. Can you keep playing that?" And yes, I can, because I think it goes on for hours. So I recommend All Night Vigil by Rachmaninoff. And of course, all of his preludes. And of course, all of his piano concertos. But I'll leave you with, let's leave you with one of the things that I think I played for a piano competition when I was 15. I think I came in second place out of two. So here it is. Here's Sergei Rachmaninoff. And thank you for listening to this Classical Minute. We'll be back with our regularly scheduled program soon.